I spend more than half my time speaking to people about this risk, and I honestly do not even view it in like the top two or three risks within the whole sort of design within Athena. If we hit a bear market tomorrow, like yields come down, funding goes negative, whatever it is, USD supply is going to shrink massively, right? You've built an insurance fund that's like with reference to $2 billion, and you're having to pay it out on a size that could be like $1 billion or half $1 billion, whatever it is. So yeah, the funding one, I'm sure I'm going to continue having to sort of speak about it. But like just speaking completely openly on my side, it's just really not the one that's top of my list.
We've teamed up with the Wormhole Foundation, stewards of the Wormhole Protocol, the leading interoperability platform powering cross-chain transfers for 200 plus multi-chain teams. Claim your unique Wormhole NFT just for 0x Research listeners today. Pair is an innovative pair trading exchange built on top of Simio. Users can trade trending narratives with one click from blue chip narratives such as long BTC, short ETH, right through the whiff versus bump. The hat stays on. Simio's intent-centric architecture enables deep liquidity, source off-chain, and broad on-chain, and combined with Pair, has democratized access to complex trading strategies typically reserved for institutional traders. Marinade is a staking protocol on Solana, and the only stake pool that delivers auto-rebalancing, MEV rewards, and automatic downside protection with new protected staking rewards. Optimize your SOL stake with Marinade by hitting the link below.
Avalanche is a smart contract platform that has a novel consensus protocol, subnet infrastructure, and the Hyper SDK toolkit, which allows Web3 developers to easily launch custom, powerful blockchain solutions. You can start building today by checking out the link below.
Before we get into today's episode, just a quick disclaimer. The views expressed on this podcast by either myself or any guests are their personal views and do not represent the views of any associated organization. Nothing in this episode should be construed or relied upon as financial, technical, tax, legal, or other advice. All right, let's jump into the episode.
What's up, everyone? Welcome back to another episode of 0x Research. We have an awesome episode lined up today with Guy, the founder of Athena, which is a protocol that probably everyone has heard of by now, unless you've been living under a rock or have been off of crypto Twitter for a while. But we're definitely excited for this one. Thanks for coming on, Guy.
No worries. Thanks for having me, guys.
Yeah. So today we are recording this. It is Monday, April 8th. So it might be a couple weeks before this airs. And as a reminder, you can use code 0xresearch10 at app.blockworksresearch.com for 10% off your annual subscription. But Guy, we spoke about 7 months ago, so we can be sure to link to that in the show notes where you explain kind of the fundamentals of Athena and how it works. So hopefully we don't have to go through all of that exactly. As we already have done, but Athena's gone through quite a bit of stuff over the last 6 months since we talked. So some big capital raises, launched mainnet, added Bitcoin as collateral type recently, grown USD supply to the billions, and of course you dropped ENA the token at the beginning of April. So how surreal has this process been, and you know, considering like how quickly it's moved, and candidly speaking from your point of view, I'd love to get like what have been the biggest challenges so far?
Yeah, I think we've obviously been pleasantly surprised that I think people took as much interest as they did in what we're doing. I think you obviously spend your life like building something in the hope that people actually care about it. So I was slightly, I would say, taken aback by, I think, some of the divisiveness around the project. So it feels, from what I see on my timeline, and you guys tell me if you see differently, but it does feel like you sort of split opinion pretty much like 50-50 down the road, where some people think it's a worthwhile product that should exist, and then others think, I'm sure you've seen all the negativity from multiple different angles. So I think from my perspective, it's just more actually getting used to when you move from like dealing with your first 100 users who tend to be people who are like your first like true fans who all think it's like a great idea to when you move to then like 100,000 and a lot of people don't like what you're doing. It's just a thing that you need to get used to. And I think we were just sort of going through that process as a team. And getting used to it.
Going back to sort of like the scaling, right? You guys have scaled a humongous amount in the past 6 months. What are some of the key challenges you've run to? Whether that's like operational risk, like sort of infrastructure?
Yeah, I think what's actually, and this I think applies more broadly to projects outside of Athena, but actually what is quite interesting about like crypto investments in general is that like, they tend to be able to scale like at the speed of software. So you don't need like 10 more people when your TVL has gone from like zero to 2 billion. Like if you put the right system in place and you've actually built what you should have, it doesn't really matter how large your TVL is relative to the actual individuals that are there on a team. So I think that's just one of the more interesting things about crypto in general. and why these things can actually be so valuable. I think the one piece that we've obviously always kept our eye on is what percentage of like the derivative market in general are we actually contributing to? Because ultimately that is like the constraint around how large USD can grow in a safe and secure way. We're obviously quite fortunate with the market timing where obviously when we were coming out, you had a lot of the bullish sentiment around, you know, the ETF like launches and stuff like that, which obviously just helped a lot of the derivative growth and actually like the funding rates to be pretty favorable. So I think we obviously recognize that, well, I'm very proud of the team in terms of the way that they actually executed, but like there was a huge element of luck in terms of the way that our growth actually came out to market. And I think we just need to recognize that piece as well. So there hasn't actually been like huge scaling challenges on our side, because we'd actually, I think, done the work in the months leading up to like our public launch to sort of do all of the testing and stuff on mainnet before we fully opened up to the public. And that was a pretty intentional decision on our side.
Yeah, speaking of that open interest kind of like being the, I guess, the scaling restraint. So you're at 20% of ETH per global open interest, roughly, to give or take a few percentage points, probably. Where is that threshold, would you say?
Yeah, we roughly think about this as somewhere between 30 to 40%. So a lot of the exchanges start to actually cap you out in terms of your percentage of open interest, like roughly within that area. I'm personally of the view that you don't want to be pushing this to the absolute extremes. I think this is obviously a reasonably new like primitive within within DeFi at least. And like it's just not within my personality to actually just want to push these things harder and faster than they should. So I think that like on the ETH contracts, we're sort of like getting up close to where that sort of limit is. But I'm sure you sort of saw the news that we put out with BTC last week. That's obviously just a huge scalability unlock for us to be able to do a lot more there. Roughly like ETH open interest at the moment, it sort of like oscillates between 10 to 12 billion. And BTC, if you exclude like the $10 billion sitting on the CME, is roughly at 25 billion at the moment. So you've got like an immediate 2.5x from where we are now, where we think we could do this pretty safely with Bitcoin. And then other assets like Solana have been pretty impressive in the way that the derivative market has grown this year. So I think that there is actually an opportunity to do that at obviously smaller scale. But I think the economics are actually pretty interesting as well to have this the same sort of cash and carry put on with Solana. So yeah, that's sort of like our view, which is 30 to 40 is like if you really want to push it extremely hard. But I think 20 to 25% of post-money open interest is sort of like where we're targeting as a team, and we're not going to be pushing too much further beyond that.
I had a follow-up question on the open interest side. Say it's the end of the bull market, and like just before the end of the bull market, Athena was 20% of global ETH per OI, and because of like a market-wide flush or whatever, ETH OI decreases by, say, 60%. And now Athena makes up 50% of like ETH OI. Is that something you guys would like consciously and actively adjust, or do you hope like the market forces will play out, the yield will come down, and like sort of like supply will contract, and thus Athena OI would also contract accordingly?
Yeah, so you never get like forced out of those positions, if that's sort of where you're getting to that question, where it's like you're sort of forced into being a higher number than you were before that type of flush. So you wouldn't actually get told like you need to close these down. I think one piece, though, that people do forget about Athena, and this sort of applies to that risk that people talk about more generally with negative funding, is that you always have the option to basically just close it down those positions and actually just sit in USDT or dollars, or potentially like an RWA if you feel like that's the direction that this sort of needs to go at a certain scale. And so I think that's just one piece where people talk about this negative funding risk as if like users are not going to respond to it, or like the Athena protocol can't respond to it. It's really not that big of a deal to basically just close it out and wait it out. And obviously in the process of doing that, closing out of positions, you do allow that funding to sort of mean revert. I think the other point around this is that actually post, like when you do see like lower funding rates is generally after those huge flush outs, that's actually when people got carried out. And if you think that that's like a longer downtrend, that's obviously when you see less positive like funding rates going forward. So I do think that there is a sort of natural unwind there where like the lower rates just lead people to redemptions as well.
I read some of the risk studies that you guys conducted maybe 6 or so months ago, and the recommendation from even third parties was about 30 million in the insurance fund for every 1 billion of outstanding supply of USDE. Would you stand by those projections? Is that kind of like the baseline you guys are still working off of?
Yeah, this was obviously done by an independent third party, and they obviously have done the work around it. I personally held like a slightly different view to the view that they had, but it wasn't like miles off. It was slightly smaller. I think we've obviously just been through a pretty incredible growth spurt at the moment, and I think we are in the process of sort of topping up that insurance fund to get it closer to those levels that were described. I think we do have a bit more flexibility now that you're obviously live with the token, and your ability to sort of like manage that treasury affords you the ability to actually just think about that a bit more strategically now than you could as like a private company. And so, yeah, going forward now, that is a piece that we're thinking about a bit more deeply at the moment. Having said that, the speed at which we're adding dollars into that insurance fund is, I'm happy with the rate that it's sort of coming through. So I think last week was just under $6 million a week of like pure cash that was added to that insurance fund. And just the sort of dynamics of how the airdrop farming at the moment is going, you guys might have noticed that you're essentially seeing the yield basically goes like in full to people who are staking within SUSD, but the portion of people who are not staking are essentially foregoing that yield to go into the insurance fund and actually build a safer product for everyone else. And so it's just during this period now, you see a pretty low stake rate across the theta. I think it's roughly at 25% at the moment. And that just sort of helps us build up that buffer at the moment as well.
In terms of risks, like I do see a lot of people like pointing to the funding risk as like being the primary one, but I would honestly challenge that viewpoint and say that like a centralized exchange going insolvent and not being able to pay out one of the short legs of Athena's proposition being an even bigger risk than the funding rate, because you already mentioned some of the things you could do to combat that. Would you agree with that opinion of mine? And if so, like what is the maximum amount you hold on a given exchange for a specific short leg? And like, I know they settle every 8 hours. So like, what would this actually look like in practice if it were to play out?
Yeah, I think I completely actually agree with your view around the negative funding. I spend more than half of my time speaking to people about this risk. And I honestly do not even view it in like the top two or three risks within the whole sort of design within Athena. I think another piece that people forget outside of what I described around your ability to just close the positions and send in dollars is also just thinking about like the dynamics of what is the size of your liability when you actually reach that scenario. So let's assume that we actually walk into a bear market like right now. You've got $2 billion of USD supply at the moment, and you've been building up that buffer when times are good and your balance sheet is actually pretty large at $2 billion. If we hit a bear market tomorrow, like yields come down, funding goes negative, whatever it is, USD supply is going to shrink massively, right? And it's going to happen pretty quickly. And so you've built up this buffer, which was like with reference to a balance sheet that was much larger. And then when you actually come to having to pay any of these liabilities when USD supply has actually shrunk, you've built an insurance fund that's like with reference to $2 billion, and you're having to pay it out on a size that could be like $1 billion or half $1 billion, whatever it is. So yeah, the funding one, I'm sure I'm going to continue having to sort of speak about it. But like just speaking completely openly on my side, it's just really not the one that's top of my list. To get to your question around the SEX exposure piece, roughly we are trying to target like open interest distribution across the market. So roughly Binance is in the order of like 50% of market share. And then you see Bybit and OKX sort of number two and three behind them on ETH contracts at least, and then pretty similar on BTC. Roughly we just want to sort of reflect the open interest within the market and never be too overweight on one side. I think getting to your point though, which is our use of like the institutional grade custodians for off exchange custody is obviously there to try and mitigate some of the risk around the credit exposure that you have to those exchanges. It doesn't actually like reduce it to zero, because as you said, you've got the hedge exposure that's sitting there. And in theory, on a day that like a major centralized venue goes down, it's likely that ETH is going to be down whatever 10-15% on the day. So essentially, yeah, the exposure that you're holding there is somewhere between 8 to 24 hours in terms of like settlement cycles between these different venues and custodians, where you would have lost like 10% of the move in ETH on that day. You wouldn't have actually captured that P&L. So if you sort of run through like the rough numbers, let's say you've got five centralized exchanges, you split yourself like evenly between them. So it's like 20 on each, and then ETH has fallen 10% on the day. You're actually kind of only at loss for like 10% times 20%. Of the entire sort of like USDE backing. So again, this is sort of like a risk where you can actually get your arms around it at least. And it's not something that sort of sends it to 80 cents on the dollar or like 50 cents on the dollar. It is, it can definitely sort of be bucketed up into single points of potential loss.
Gotcha. I appreciate that explanation. I wanted to ask a question about sort of ETH collateral from the dashboard. This may be a few days old, but roughly 10 to 20% of Athena's ETH collateral is actually in LSTs. Is this risk management that you guys sort of deem necessary post-launch? And does it not partially negate the value proposition if funding goes negative, the stake ETH yield will help offset it? Basically, why not more of the ETH collateral in like liquid staking tokens?
Yeah, it's a really good point. And I think it's one of those things that, we're going to be coming out with like a bit of a governance post around this week to actually just sort of like explain the team's viewpoint and how that's actually changed through time. To actually just get people's opinions in terms of how that sort of like managed going forward. It's a funny one because a lot of actually the risks that people point towards with Athena, and one that I've seen quite consistently, is just thinking about the liquidity and duration risk that you're sort of embedding within Athena because you're using LSTs rather than just raw ETH. So as you know, all of these things are just trade-offs. So if you want to get yield and return, you're making some sort of trade-off in terms of the liquidity and duration risk that you're assuming with LSTs. I think it is a bit of a misunderstanding from a lot of people that like they assume that STETH equals ETH and they are not the same assets at all. And there's a reason that you're actually getting paid that yield and that return. But I just wanted to give you guys a bit of context in terms of the way that we thought about the product construction and like the context at the time. This is like the beginning of 2023 when staked ETH yields were like closer to 6%. And like the basis on shorting ETH was call it 6 to 10%. And so you look at that and you're getting paid on both sides of both legs of that transaction and roughly an equal magnitude. And so to me, that was an interesting pickup relative to like the economics of the whole product at the time. What we've seen for like a variety of different reasons is obviously like ETH staking go up massively through the roof. The returns on staking ETH is like roughly 3.5% now on most major LSTs. And then you've obviously seen the basis like expand to north of 30% this year. And so like the balance of like the returns that you're making in a bull market has really shifted from like 50-50 to like less than 5% or 10% of the total yield is actually coming from liquid staking tokens. But you are introducing this risk that a lot of people seem to be concerned around. So I think my view here is that actually you've got the flexibility to go back into LSTs at like a smaller supply. Let's say you do shrink in the bear market to a smaller supply. You do retain that option to be able to go back and use that to try and bolster the unit economics. But I think my perspective is that during a bull market, people don't really care about 3.5% from LSTs. They just care about the basis from centralized exchanges and actually just solving for like a more liquid and safer product in the bull market while sort of giving up some of that yield, we think is actually a more prudent sort of approach at the moment. So we're going to be coming out with how we try and define and think about what that balance actually looks like. But the thing that I'll just like reinforce here is that it doesn't mean that you'd have zero exposure to LSTs in the bear. It's just that you retain the option to sort of increase that allocation as you do get there. Yeah.
No, I definitely agree with that point. Like taking or receiving an additional 2.5% yield for whatever like additional smart contract risks that you're taking like just never really seemed worth it. Even in like a bear market, like to me that was like a little crazy. But sticking on the question of collateral, just off the dashboard, roughly like 30%+ of the collateral is in USDT. And from my understanding, like you guys take that USDT, you open up like you buy like either ETH or like Bitcoin spot, and then you sort of like hedge that out through the perp leg. Just like conceptually, why does that count as USDT collateral on the dashboard instead of like whatever asset you converted that USDT into?
Yeah, I think it might be worth just like refreshing the tab that you're looking at now. This is actually just as we're ramping up the BTC that we sort of announced last Friday. So the way that sort of BTC is introduced into the system is that instead of having to deal with actually using like native BTC or thinking about like complications of like wrapped BTC on Ethereum, it was basically just easier for like the flow of funds to basically come through as like USDT into three Athena's front end on Ethereum. And then we basically dealt with the execution in the background with the custodians and the centralized exchanges to then go straight into native BTC. That obviously just helps to make it cheaper for users and sort of like manage the slippage and liquidity risk around it. I think the one moment that you're just referencing there is that we'd warehoused quite a bit of USDT getting ready for the announcement around BTC. And I think if you refresh it now, you'll see that there's close to $500 million of BTC that was sort of added since that period. At the moment, it's just sitting there as sort of collateral in that dashboard, because that is obviously part of the backing. I think one of the pieces just to make people aware of at the moment is that we do run a very small amount of USDT that's sitting there as like a liquid withdrawal buffer. So in the same way that Lido has like ETH on hand for people to get out quickly without any sort of like redemption queue, we do have like liquid USDT that's sitting at the bottom of the stack, which is sort of like replenished as people have redemptions and come out. So that's just a way that we're trying to sort of like optimize around the execution for people who are wanting to get out. And so there will always be some small portion of like USDT that's sitting there, because you do need to remember that a lot of the contracts that we're using are linear perpetual contracts. So they're actually collateralized with USDT, and then the funding payments are paid in USDT as well. So there is naturally like USDT entering our system just by the nature of like the contracts that we're actually using on the other side.
Gotcha. That makes sense. Really appreciate you for clarifying that. And then one last question on the collateral side. I don't think you guys would ever consider doing this in a bull market, but in a bear market, would Athena ever dabble in LRT protocols, or is that just way too far out on the risk of to even consider?
The honest answer is I think we don't know enough about the market or haven't sort of like seen it behave to make like a strong view on that at the moment. I think my philosophical view at the moment is that the opportunity is big enough with what we're doing at the moment to not go like full degen. And I think that people are sort of part of the concerns that you're actually seeing from people is a concern that we are just going to go like into full degen mode and run this as hard as you can. That's just not what I personally want to do. And I don't think it sort of like makes sense for the protocol at the moment. I do think you can do interesting things around like structured vaults, where instead of actually like putting it into the backing of USD, you can use some of the infrastructure that we've built to potentially do like an LRT like pendle type setup, where you actually just sort of like dollarize the way that that's being built. I think that's more of like a small side addition to the product rather than something that sits within the core product, where we just want to make that as robust and scalable as possible as the core piece of what we're doing. I also have like pretty significant concerns around the impact of like what Eigenlayer is going to have onto DeFi, and like specifically around like the liquidity profile of DeFi going forward. And I think this is part of where my concerns lie with like the LST backing within Athena as well, which is, I think Eigenlayer is basically just going to push the ETH staking rate higher than it actually would be in any normal circumstances without the existence of Eigenlayer. And that obviously has like second order implications for products like ours, which have been built on the assumption that staked ETH is actually going to produce a sufficient return for the risk that you're assuming. That's just one thing that we're sort of keeping an eye on, because I think there could be some like less like savory second order implications of like Eigenlayer, specifically on like the liquidity profile of DeFi going forward.
Wormhole is the leading interoperability platform for multi-chain bridges and applications. With over 1 billion messages sent and 40 billion in value transferred, Wormhole leads the industry in cross-chain message volume and total value transferred. If you're a builder, Wormhole has an extensive suite of tools and infrastructure to securely build multi-chain applications. You can use Wormhole to power DeFi, NFTs, governance, and so much more. And Wormhole supports over 30 blockchains and 6 different runtimes. Claim your unique Wormhole NFT just for 0x Research listeners today. Fill out a form, prove that you've listened to today's episode to receive a Pro app, and you'll get an email over the coming weeks to claim your limited edition NFT. Pair is an innovative pair trading exchange built on top of Simio. Users can trade trending narratives with one click, from blue chip narratives such as long BTC, short ETH, right through the whiff versus bump. The hat stays on. Simio's intent-centric architecture enables deep liquidity, source off-chain, and broad on-chain, and combined with Pair, has democratized access to complex trading strategies typically reserved for institutional traders. Marinade is optimized Solana staking. Stake natively or liquid stake with Marinade and get the same high-performance delegation strategy that thousands are using today to stake your SOL to over 100 of the best Solana validators. The delegation strategy is a first of its kind and only possible on Solana. It delegates your SOL to the network's best validators with no smart contract risk. In addition, Marinade has just built a new and improved delegation strategy that delivers maximum performance with auto-rebalancing, MEV rewards, and automatic downside protection with new protected staking rewards. And this allows for maximum decentralization for Solana too. Optimize your SOL staking today with Marinade by hitting the link below.
The age of interoperability is here. With the launch of Teleporter, Avalanche becomes a seamlessly linked network of many sovereign blockchains that communicate so smoothly, they feel like a single chain. Teleporter is an EVM-compatible cross-chain communication protocol built on top of Avalanche Corp Messaging. It allows any EVM chain on Avalanche to send messages, assets, and data to one another in a simple, fast, affordable, and secure way. Teleporter and Avalanche Corp Messaging provide a new foundation for how Avalanche blockchains can communicate. and how developers can easily build cross-chain applications out of the box. Build anything you want, any way you want, on the eco-friendly blockchain designed for Web3 devs. Check it out by clicking the link below.
Switching gears here, you guys have absolutely like murdered BD in partnerships, probably one of the best teams I've seen do it, honestly, since my time in crypto. So congrats on that. But you have big partnerships with certain L2s, Perps DEXs, Pendle, and other applications. How do you go about prioritizing integrations? How hard is it to set up? Like, can you just kind of speak to the BD side of things?
Yeah, I think obviously the team has done like a good job, I think, getting it in front of the key people that matter. The way I sort of view these things is very much like that classic sort of power law, where whether it's like your relationships with people in CeFi, big LPs, or like DeFi apps, it's going to be like two or three who have like 80% of the impact, and then like everything else is just like slightly less important. And I think you've seen that with some of the partnerships that we've done, where I've just tried and like focus people in on like really identifying and focusing in on who are the two to three key partnerships that are really going to move the needle, and then make sure that that's done in a really like focused way. It's pretty easy for us to integrate. It's just like an ERC-20 that we sort of give to people and sort of give a bit of guidance around the integration. It's much less involved than another project, whether it's like a base layer that's trying to attract new builders to come on, or like a messaging protocol or whatever it is. Really for us, we can get integrations done in like a day or two. It's actually more of the time is actually spent doing like risk analysis with the other team, so that they're actually comfortable with what we're doing on our side. And so I think a lot of the people who'd seen the speed that Maker was sort of moving on some of their proposals were a bit taken back, I think, with like how conservative they've traditionally been as a protocol. What I can say is, just sitting on the other side of that, they were probably the most diligent counterparty that we sort of faced through this entire process. Includes like every investor that we spoke to, or like exchange or whoever it is. It was like a very detailed process where they were actually getting into details that a lot of people hadn't ever really surfaced. So that is where more of actually the time goes into, which is just getting people sort of like up to speed around how the whole thing works.
Following up on the topic of integrations, you know, like there's a few different ways that SUSD or USDE is being integrated into various DeFi protocols. And some of that is just airdrop farmers or just average crypto users like looping the staking yield. Is that something you guys like actively think about from a risk management perspective? Because obviously like for the stake deep trade where they leverage loop the yield, there's like a potential for that to blow up and like stake deep to significantly depeg. Are you guys thinking about like a similar type of risk for SUSDE? And is that something you guys are like actively managing, or the same thing? You're just like hoping market forces will eventually balance it out?
It is actually. So I don't think it's actually acceptable for a team to just say like, these are permissionless markets, go ahead and do whatever you want, because like ultimately we're incentivizing a lot of this activity. And if you're just going to recklessly like incentivize some of the more like leverage, is obviously just increases the risk in general, like for the system. And if you're just going to be doing that without like any thoughtful like second order impact, I think that would be pretty irresponsible for us as a team to be doing. I did put out like a thread on this on Twitter where we did make clear that there are very specific nuances around USD, which people should like take note of before they're actually using it within these leveraged money markets. And even with the MakerDAO news that came out, where they were talking about numbers of like 600 to a billion, we've made very clear to them, and this came out in the blog post that we put out today, that we're sort of doing it in 100 million blocks as people sort of get comfortable, and we're not going to be incentivizing more than that. This isn't like me saying this to try and concern people. It's just, again, these are like net new things that we're doing. There's a lot of like new infrastructure and impacts around like Athena's USD, where it doesn't make sense to sort of rush this, I think, for anyone. And we just want to make sure that we're being like responsible actors within the space as well.
Speaking of incentives, you guys just launched your Sats campaign about a week ago, and today just announced a 50% boost or some type of boost for ENA lockers. Can you guys kind of give us an overview of what that looks like?
Yeah, I think the basic idea here was just trying to tie people's like ownership within ENA to like the growth of USD going forward, and just reward people who have sort of been involved with the ecosystem and sort of like continue to actually support it. So I think it was something that we've been pretty clear about in like the initial blog post that we put out, where we just said this isn't supposed to be like a quick farm and dump and then sort of people move on afterwards. We're actually really trying to align people for the long term. So we did put in a 6-month vesting on actually the initial airdrop as well. which I did think we were going to get quite a bit of pushback for, but didn't actually see that much of it. I think people sort of understood just the speed at which we did the like initial sort of like shards announcement, actually dropping the token was actually relatively quick, I think, compared to a lot of other teams. And so I think people sort of like get it that you want to put a bit of vesting around that and just make sure you're aligning incentives. So yeah, that's the only piece that we sort of introduced with the token piece at the moment. Yeah.
Yeah, I think that vest made a lot of sense considering the initial shards campaign was only 6 weeks long. So I think that's a kind of a fair trade off there. But you mentioned earlier that you wanted to post a governance post this week. How are you thinking about protocol governance? Like how active of a role will token holders play in setting some of the parameters, some of the strategies? Like obviously this is a new system, so you need to be able to move nimbly as well. So I imagine trying to form your governance structure is a bit of a challenge.
Yeah, and I think this is something that like naturally happens in the beginning, right? Where I think actually holders sometimes want the team to be taking a bit more direction in the beginning and actually just guiding, because they're obviously closest to the whole thing around what their actual views are. I do think that there's really interesting places that, that governance can actually play a role, whether it's thinking about like the composition of like the insurance fund, what is actually the allocation of like cash flows that are going into there, and like even like the sizing discussion that we're having like earlier, all of the things that we're talking about in terms of like composition of like new products, LRTs, does that even make sense? These are all things that are like ultimately the users are actually using the product, and we want to understand like what their actual viewpoint is in terms of like the composition and like risk profile of it going forward. So that is the idea, that they can play a pretty significant role there in actually sort of like guiding where those parameters actually go.
Jumping back to incentives, how are you guys thinking about long-term incentive programs, given that I'm guessing the angle will be to scale Athena as large as feasibly possible, and likely you need new incentives for every new type of collateral you want to onboard. Maybe it isn't for like this bull market, but like two cycles later, there's like probably 10 assets that you guys are running like the same trade and collecting yield on. How do you think about incentives in sort of like the end game of Athena?
Yeah, I think obviously at some point you run out of these things, and so you've just always got to like acknowledge that it's not like a never-ending like gravy train for people to be involved in. And like at the end, you need to work out, have you actually found a product that people actually want to use, or was it all just there like as a farming gimmick? It was something that I did think about quite a bit when we did the airdrop so quickly, which is I think people, there's like a pretty strong inverse correlation between a team's own confidence in like the product market fit of what they built, and how long they sort of like extend out those programs. And so my view was always like sort of get to the end of that first sort of season as quickly as possible, and actually see like how many people sort of like dropped off immediately. I think I was like pleasantly surprised with how people sort of stayed on. And I think the one thing that I would point towards just as sort of like the long-term sustainability of what we're doing is we do fundamentally think that we've created like the highest returning like USD denominated asset in crypto like through the cycle. Obviously that's going to be up and down, and there's going to be volatility within that rate, but ultimately that was sort of like the killer product of why you saw like Luna and I think like Anchor grow up to the size that it was last cycle. It was literally just put a dollar into an app for a 20% like imaginary yield basically. So we do think that that is like actually producing a dollar with one of the highest returns in the market is basically the like killer app of DeFi. And you can see that in the way that it's being plugged into these other apps, because dollars are like the lifeblood of every other sort of like app, whether it's trading, money markets, even perp DEXs, they all sort of like need dollars to function. And so ultimately we think that like, yes, you'll have incentives in the beginning, but that sort of like core piece of the product, which we think has like a structural advantage to what other people are doing, that's actually like the piece that we need to lean on at the end.
Following that, have you observed any interesting like user behavior patterns throughout like the 6 to 8 week period of USDE, or like anything that's caught your eye so far?
I don't know why I'm mentioning this one first, but I think the most interesting one was like we obviously dropped a bit to some of those NFT communities, which you might have seen, and they've been like complete diamond hands. So like I think the ladies, for whatever reason, have like completely held on to their like free airdrop that came through, which I was just quite surprised from in general. We've obviously seen like a bit of a migration from like people in the staking USD contract into basically just like overweight now on trying to farm the points. I think that was sort of like a result of us as a team actually just doing what we said we were going to do. It's quite interesting to actually just see the market response, where they were like surprised that we even basically just did what we outlined that we would do. And I think that sort of like doing it in the way that we did in the first season earned a little bit of people's trust that sort of the way we'd do this going forward wouldn't be there to just try like extract as much value as you could from users, which I think people have sort of got a bit used to over the last couple of like months and years within crypto, with some projects sort of extending these things like much better than they should.
Yeah, I did want to ask. I mean, this isn't, you guys aren't the first to try a delta neutral product like this. So what would you attribute to Athena's success versus previous projects that have tried and really not reached anywhere near the same scale as you guys?
Yeah, I think it's more just like pragmatism around focusing on like how do you scale. That's always been like the big piece in my mind, which is just like every trade-off that you're making, try and solve for like scalability as like the most important piece. And so like obviously the other projects who had done this fully on chain had obviously optimized for more of the elements around decentralization. I just took a very strong view that actually people don't care about that as much as we think they do. And if you can sort of be open and honest with them around the trade-offs that you are making to sort of unlock that scalability, it would be something that they could sort of like get behind. So I think that's really the only core difference. And I think the team's just been like super focused on executing like really as quick as possible. So that's just like the culture I've tried to instill with people, which is just like ship fast, ship like secure, and just make sure that we're sort of like focusing on scalability the whole time.
Jumping back to your governance question, you mentioned like a few things that token holders may potentially like have a say in, like controlling, whether that's like the insurance fund composition, sort of like the collateral makeup. I want to say that historically DAO participants have not been the best quantitative risk managers by like any margin. I think Aave is like a great example of that. And so do you trust ENA holders to act responsibly around like these various like quantitative parameters, where like realistically you need like professional like quantitative risk managers to like do this job, rather than like just token holders who more often than not act in self-interest?
Yeah, and just to be clear on this one, it's not sort of like getting token holders to vote down to like the minutiae of detail around everything, because I think that's just like practically impossible, and we've sort of learned that over the last few years of DAO governance. I think the frameworks that sort of make the most sense, and the ones that I'd admired the most from the outside in, is setting up like councils that look a little bit similar to the way that sort of synthetics run things, where you just have people who are obviously more knowledgeable in different subsegments, and actually just like professional firms who are hired to do this, whether it's like a Chaos Labs or a Gauntlet. All I'm trying to say here is that the governance, like the token holders, can obviously have a contribution to actually just like signal where do they sort of like feel things make the most sense, and you obviously engage professionals to actually do the work and produce it so that people can sort of like make those decisions afterwards. So yeah, just to be clear on that one, we're not like expecting like deep modeling work from governance token holders on like the insurance fund. It's just more sort of like guiding towards the professionals who obviously can do that work.
Yeah, I definitely share that view with you. I think it's good to have professionals in there making decisions. But I did want to circle back to the Bitcoin collateral adding. Do you have any aspirations to source yield on the underlying Bitcoin, or do you think like, nah, like let's see how this goes for scaling up to like the full capacity and then maybe go there? Or like at that point, would you not even be interested in Bitcoin yield through like maybe like a Babylon or something like that, and you'd be more interested in adding other collateral types?
Yeah, again, with this, I'm just quite skeptical that you can like really get yield on Bitcoin and scale. That one way you can do it is what some of those CeFi lending platforms are doing, which is basically just lending it out to hedge funds who are like shorting it on the other side. We can't do that because we're using like BTC as collateral to actually collateralize the hedge. So you can't go and rehypothecate those assets and lend it out and stuff. And that's just not really what I think is actually just like an interesting business. Around Babylon, I don't really know enough of like how you actually produce those yields at scale. And I think that this is a bit of my, I think Eigenlayer is one of the most amazing ideas like in the last few years, but I do have a bit of skepticism around like a real yield that can actually be produced on this at like $10 billion plus in size. So it all sort of like works now when you've got the Eigenlayer farming, when you've got different projects who are going to be airdropping their own tokens, which obviously give you like a paper yield, but nothing that's like sort of like real in terms of projects paying like real cash flow for that yield. So yeah, I think we can talk about these things in concept, but I haven't seen any robust analysis around how you actually produce real yield on any of these sort of systems at like $10 billion plus in size. I think from my perspective, there's actually only two sources of real yield in the market at like $10 billion plus in size, and that's basically Ethereum Bloxos through Steeth, and then the basis on the centralized exchange market. So I think we've already got access to the only two forms of like scalable real yield in the market. And everything else, I think we just need to see like pay through for another cycle before you can actually work out whether it's sort of scalable to the same extent.
Speaking of scalable real yield, like has, you know, actual treasuries been thought of? Like I'm kind of surprised given where rates are that that's not an asset on the roadmap considering how many other products there are out there that tokenize treasury yield.
Yeah, it's obviously it would be a slight like violation of like the narrative of what we're trying to do, which is like produce a synthetic dollar that's outside of the banking system. I think that there is maybe a question when you're at a much larger size, which is like, do you care more about that narrative or doing a bit more of like what MakerDAO has done? And there's obviously just more scalability that you can do there, but you'd obviously be dragging down the overall sort of yield. I do think it's something that we're probably going to have to make a tough decision around that somewhere towards the end of the bull market and into the bear, where it'll be interesting to see where sort of like funding and like crypto rates sort of end up towards the end of the cycle. And this might just be something that you decide to do for three to 6 months to sort of like get through the worst of it. So I don't want to rule it out entirely. I just think in a bull market, there's like really no reason for like RWAs to exist as a product. And I think you've sort of seen that as a, in terms of their market share, even like since October, like stablecoins are up like $25 to $30 billion from the bottom. And RWAs have like lost 25% market share since then. So I know it's like just a bit of a narrative that people trade. But I think like if you just look at any of the data, like no one's actually sort of like growing that product outside of what BlackRock brought to market last week.
You mentioned that there's like a potential that you guys are considering Sol as the next asset. But I know like just for this cycle, like that's probably like the only asset left that you guys can generate like significant yield at size on. In the long term, what does the inclusion criteria look like, given that, you know, this is going to be a continuous process? Like every single, like a few months, you guys are going to be evaluating new assets. Every new cycle, total crypto market cap is going to be larger. There's going to be like a larger total open interest across the entire asset class. How do you guys think about like the inclusion criteria for new assets, or more specifically new collateral?
Yeah, I think roughly you kind of, it doesn't make sense for us to spend engineering time thinking about it if it doesn't sort of get to call it like $300 to $500 million in terms of capacity for us to put it on. So yeah, Sol kind of just crossed like over $2 billion of OI quite recently. So that's sort of like in the ballpark of what we're describing there for an asset that could sort of like sustain that amount. I don't think you want to push it as hard, like as high and as hard into open interest sort of constraints as you did with BTC and ETH. I think we just sort of need to see Sol play out as an asset for a bit longer. But yeah, that's roughly how we think about things, which is like low to mid nine figures of capacity within the derivative market. If that makes sense, then something to sort of like consider.
In terms of integrations with SUSD and USDE itself, is there any use cases that you'd like to see implemented that you haven't seen yet that actually like really excite you? Like obviously we see, I believe one Perps Dex is introduced it as a collateral type. Maybe it was in 10x, correct me on that if I'm wrong, but that's like super cool to me. So is there any other things you can think of that you'd love to see built?
That is the one I was about to say. So you stole my thunder over that. Maybe if I could just speak about that one, because it is like top of my list. We're going to be doing something very similar to Synthetics, which went up as like a SIP last week on Arbitrum. So that again, I think is quite exciting to me, because I think people sort of forget about just the size of the market for linear margin perps using Tether. So there's around $20 billion of Tether, where the only use case right now is just putting it down to trade a perp on the other side. And the guys who typically are trading the most size in perps and kind of like foregoing like the most interest are the trading funds who are most familiar with what a cash and carry is and sort of familiar with the risk profile. So I do think that that is actually going to be one of the largest organic growth activities that you sort of see around SUSD, which is if you're holding $100 million of perps as one of the largest trading funds within the space, it's actually a pretty big deal to not be making $10, $20, $30 million of like annual revenue on that position that you are sort of like foregoing to Tether. And so, yeah, that to me is probably the most exciting growth avenue after we've done all of what we want to do within DeFi, which I think call it like 80%. Of the money market type integrations are sort of there. This is like the big piece for me, which is like centralized exchanges, really allowing this as perp margin collateral, and then helping push that product for you as well.
In terms of DAO treasury diversification, I view that as an interesting use case. Obviously, I would think most DAOs would be, you know, hesitant given how novel the product is. But considering you're getting 5 to 10x the yield, even if you only put 5 or 10% of the treasury in there, you're still doing pretty darn well. Is that an avenue that you guys have, I guess, spent resources pursuing? Or is that something that you think would just happen organically over time as the stable becomes battle tested?
Yeah, we have actually had a few DAO treasuries hold like reasonable positions. So Mantle has obviously been a big supporter of us from day one, and they've got a reasonably large position within USD as well. There's a few smaller projects as well, some that used to be related to like Olympus, who are doing something similar. I do think it's just a bit more difficult to push these things through because as we were sort of discussing out there, DAO governance is not like the easiest place to just have like a level-headed sort of like argument around risk-adjusted like decision-making. I think the point that you're making though is a very good one, which is people obviously sort of try and compare the risk of this to something that has like no embedded return at all, like a comparison to like a normal fiat stablecoin, where I think that's a pretty simplistic way to view these things, where you should always be thinking about these things on risk-adjusted basis. So where like a USDC, you got paid zero and then got like 10% haircut in the beginning of 2023 for like the privilege. That didn't seem like actually a great trade to me. While here, like you can, yes, there are risks that are sort of associated to it, but I think if you can size up those risks relative to the return, I think most people sort of arrive at the conclusion that it's actually not a bad sort of profile to take on. And so, yeah, I think it sort of makes sense as some smaller part of the portfolio. It should never be like 100% of anyone's allocation to dollars. I think that sort of makes sense as a diversification asset going forward as well, for sure.
You mentioned Intendex and Synthetix as sort of like DeFi protocols that are integrating SUSDE. And you also mentioned that, you know, the end game is to eventually integrate this into centralized exchanges as like a margin asset. What does that conversation look like? What are some of the factors that centralized exchanges consider when they're willing to integrate something as like a collateral asset, given like the baseline is USDT, which is like this $100 billion stablecoin with a really long track record?
Yeah, I think that they do similar things to this the whole time. So even just one example, like Meth, for example, was allowed as collateral on Bybit not too long ago, where you could actually just put down Meth at like 7.5% yield and collateralize that to put on like actually a very similar delta neutral sort of trade that Athena is doing at the moment. All of these things are just accounted for in the way that like money markets think about like collateral factors as well. So if it's lower liquidity and like the trading volumes aren't great, and the market cap's not huge, it's just not going to get treated like one for one, like you see with USDT. And so I think all you really need to demonstrate is that there is pretty significant trading volumes around these instruments and that people will actually be excited to come and actually use the product on their venue to sort of make it worth their while. And then I think they'll just do a basic risk assessment around where they would actually collateralize that relative to like a one times factor that you see with USDT. So yeah, I think that's one piece. And then I think the other one to just consider here is that there's obviously scope for them to make a reasonable amount of money with actually like integrating SUSD as a per margin collateral as well. So if it's producing 15, 20, 25% return, it's not out of the question that some of these exchanges will just say, well, I'm going to keep 5% of that and only pass on the rest to like users who are trading on the other side as well. So I think that is one piece that sort of needs to be factored in there as well, which is just like their incentive alignment behind pushing this as well.
Feel free to push back on this question. It's just coming to me. But do you think it's a slight conflict of interest if an exchange supports SUSDE as margin collateral, but at the same time, the short leg of like the position is also carried out on the same exchange?
You do start to see like some circularity like fall into the whole thing. And I think that is something that we just need to like start considering a bit more deeply if that does start to grow in a very significant way. I don't think this is going to be something that you see at like $5, $10 billion of size on these venues. They're going to be capping out as they would with any sort of like new types of collateral coming through. If I'm being totally honest, it's not something that I've like fully thought through in terms of the loop of that, the self-referential element of that whole thing. But obviously the fact that you're actually diversified across multiple venues and like multiple collateral types in the same instrument obviously helps to alleviate that wave. I think you're just doing it on one venue with one, just ETH as like the backing and then using that to trade an ETH pap. I think that there would be some like odd second order implications there as well.
When it comes to like, I guess, pegged products, like liquidity is ultimately king. So have you thought about protocol and liquidity? And do you think at the same time that Ethereum will remain like kind of the go-to de facto home of USDE pairs?
Yeah, I think, as you pointed out, liquidity is always, and this is something I think we learned from like Lido and Tether as well, which is a lot of these protocols or businesses, the biggest moat that they can establish is basically a liquidity moat from like day one. Why is it that that's the case within crypto? It's because everything has to do with speculation, and like liquidity is like the lifeblood of speculation. And so if you're not solving for that, you're basically going to be at a disadvantage to someone else that does. So yeah, for us, it was like a huge piece of the way that we're incentivizing things early on. Where at the moment, I think on like the day that we came out this week, we accounted for like 70% of the curve volumes was just through the USDE pools on like the, I think it was April the 2nd. And like quite consistently, you're seeing USDE put on like $600 to $900 million of on-chain flows, which is a pretty like astounding number relative to actually just the size of USDE itself. So yeah, I think liquidity is huge. This is like one of the key reasons why it's actually quite interesting for some of the larger balance sheets within the space, which is it has like a pretty reflexive nature to it. In the same way that like Bitcoin only becomes interesting to some people at like $1 trillion in size, certain assets only become like, you can only touch them when they do become like X liquid and allow like some of the larger balance sheets to actually get in and out with less slippage. So that is a core piece here. And I think that if you do actually establish a proper liquidity moat around what we're doing and sort of become the first person who is 20% of the open interest in the market, that's actually the moat around Athena that you're trying to build, which becomes quite hard to actually like surpass later on.
Just one more question on the liquidity side of things. I think one reason why liquidity is really important for perhaps other assets such as like StakeDeF is because there's this sort of unknown like withdrawal / unstaking period, right? And so people want that instant liquidity available so that they can swap out of this like quote unquote like derivative asset. Whereas for USDE, that concern doesn't seem as justified given that the redemption process is like relatively quick and within a known time frame compared to like these other derivative assets. So in the long term, like how do you think about those liquidity dynamics? Is it just like the more liquidity the better, or like as long as USDE maintains its ability to redeem like relatively quickly, then like on-chain liquidity is like just not that important?
Yeah, I think like up to a certain size, it's extremely useful. And then there's like extreme diminishing returns to like building liquidity up to like, you know, multi nine figures on chain. A lot of the time it's just sitting there as like wasted and unused. Even as one example, like the Uniswap pool that we have, which is a pretty tight, like tight range LP pool in UniV3, that was doing like $480 million of volume on April the 2nd on just $10 million of TVL. So you don't actually need a lot that's actually sitting in there if you're sort of running things efficiently in the way that we're pegging the ARB mechanism to actually the mint and redeem contract with Athena. So it's really like additional liquidity on the margin is just if people want to be swapping like $5, $10 million transactions in one go and can't be bothered to sort of like work that through in an AMM over time. But yeah, I tend to agree with you that I think a lot of people over-index on having like these enormous like idle pools of liquidity sitting in curve. And if you're sort of smarter around the way that you do that with some like tight Uniswap positions and stuff like that, it's not totally necessary in the go forward.
Awesome. Well, Guy, thank you so much for coming back on and joining us. Do you want to share with the listeners maybe where they can find you on Twitter and where they can learn more about Athena?
Yep. It's Athena_labs on Twitter, and then the website's app.athena.fi. And then my Twitter handle is a bit long and complicated, leptocathic. So I don't know if you could just maybe post a link to that one.
Yeah, we'll link to that one for sure. We were actually joking before. We're like, we don't know how to pronounce this guy's Twitter name. Awesome, Guy. Well, thank you so much. Best of luck. And we'll be sure to get you back on here in the next 6 to 12 months for a rerun.
Awesome. Appreciate it, guys.
Thank you. Thank you. Bye-bye. We have teamed up with the Wormhole Foundation, stewards of the Wormhole Protocol, the leading interoperability platform powering cross-chain transfers for over 200+ multi-chain dApps. Wormhole isn't just a bridge. It's the leading interoperability platform for multi-chain applications. So go and claim your unique Wormhole NFTs just for 0x research listeners today. Hit the link in the description to fill out a form and to prove that you've listened to today's episode and receive a PoApp. You get an email over the coming weeks to claim your limited edition NFT.